welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I am your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the remainder of this half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Heroes in the Sand. Heroes in the Sand. We're talking about films that depict some form of armed conflict in a desert setting. And I guess to kick things off in terms of films that do that, when we're in the desert, I suppose, and there being some kind of armed conflict there. I mean, if we think about places like the Middle East, for example, it's been a hotbed of human conflict for a very long time. And I guess we could say that any kind of film about desert warfare can be used to kind of illustrate some of the underlying pressures and the underlying issues that have happened in regions like the Middle East. But specifically with respect to the Middle East and its history of being, you know, a pretty war-torn region ever since it's been inhabited by human beings. I think whenever we're talking about films that are set in the desert, you're inevitably going to have some kind of biblical or Abrahamic imagery, or at least we can have some kind of, there can be some kind of dialogue between these films and the biblical stories, or any kind of stories of any of the Abrahamic faiths, and using one to sort of tell a story about the other, or you use one or the other to contrast with the other to sort of distinguish characters from sort of ancient stories from modern stories, and vice versa. So having this backdrop of the desert kind of, I suppose it can kind of serve as like this constant reminder of, you know, what we, you know, if you're a religious person, what you might aspire to be. And also a question of like what the divine has shown itself to be, as opposed to what we sort of see in these, what we see in these films. And kind of, I think a lot of these films do sort of lift up this question of what's actually the difference between those ideas, like the difference between a person aspiring to be divine and what divine figures have actually done in the ancient religious texts, and what the difference is between sort of a divine person and a mere mortal sort of thing. But I guess on a broader level as well, if we're talking about any kind of film that's set in the desert, we're definitely in the territory of scarcity, which is something we talked about last week. And, you know, how should we act in a place where things are quite desolate and people are in a state of vulnerability and are, you know, they could be quite volatile given what's at stake and how little they have to play with. And so time is always of the essence. Resources are always highly and extremely valuable. So things can get hot and messy pretty quickly given how quickly things can turn bad and that sort of thing. And so when we have questions about that and how hot and volatile and sort of famine-threatened a lot of these conditions are, or famine-threatening the conditions, I should say, is very topical to a lot of things that are happening in the world today. And I think that a lot of these films that we talk about, and a lot of the themes that they have, can certainly be applied not only to the Middle East, specifically to, you know, the second sort of point I made about, you know, the biblical in the modern day, but also just broadly on any for any kind of group or community or group of people that are in a state of volatility or vulnerability. They don't have to be living in a desert per se, but how we should treat people who are in a state of, who live in a condition where time and resources aren't plentiful, I guess you could say. So the first film we're going to talk about is a big one. It's David Lean's 1962 film Lawrence of Arabia. Then I'm going to move on to Ridley Scott's 2001 film Black Hawk Down. Then we're going to finish off, of course, with Dune Part 2. Big film from this year, directed by Denis Villeneuve. But let's kick things off now with Lawrence of Arabia. And it's a huge film, so kind of trying to go through the synopsis is not going to be that helpful. But in short, we've got T.E. Lawrence, who is a real guy, played by Peter O'Toole, who goes into Arabia during the First World War to help a lot of the Arabic tribes fight against the Turks, who the British obviously wanted to fight as part of the war. And there's a whole thing about sort of him leading them. To what extent is he bringing them freedom? Is it a personal endeavor? Is it a broader political endeavor for the British? And kind of sets the scene for, I suppose, what happened in the Middle East since the end of the First World War and why it came to be such a messy situation, or more of a messy situation than maybe it was prior to that. And just before we get into like the analysis of the film itself, I want to sort of from the get-go this week talk about this kind of three you'd almost say three kind of archetypal groups that are depicted in this film that we're going to see played around within the other two films as well. So we've got kind of the innocents, the aggressors, and the interveners, let's say. So the innocents are the Arabs, the aggressors are the Turks, at least in the world of this film. And then we've got the people who are intervening are the British, obviously. And I want you to sort of think about, and I want us to think about this week, about how those different groups are depicted in each film we talk about and through time, and how they have different characteristics. So I've used the word archetype, but they do sort of mix and mold and change a little bit as the eras go by. So it is an interesting point to make from the get-go. But the specific lens that I want to talk about Lawrence of Arabia through is how it conveys this idea of the illusion, or dare I say, the mirage of righteous mortal leadership. So how it's a bit of an illusion to think that a mere mortal human being individual can be a perfectly righteous leader in a place such as the one that we described before, you know, full of volatility and vulnerability and scarcity and that sort of thing. And there's this interesting debate throughout the film about, you know, things being written and things not being written. So whenever someone's fate is sort of brought into question in the film, the Arabs at the beginning of at least in the first part of the film say things like, oh, he's fell off his camel. It was written. It was like there's this sense of fate. And then they come to respect Lawrence because at least at the beginning of the film, he's sort of like, nothing is written. Everything can be asserted. It's a very sort of Rudyard Kipling, very overly British idea of, you know, we can conquer this world. Man is impressive and can write his own story, write his own plot. And I suppose the subtext of that is kind of like a theocracy versus classical liberal Western democracy, which is, you know, theocracy kind of puts a lot of emphasis on the written word, that fate is written out by God and your destiny is written out. It's through sort of a classical kind of liberal Western democratic ideology. We feel like human beings are on a roll here. We are coming up with new things. We can sort of defy God's expectations of us and come up with machines and new ways of looking at things. And at least in the first part of this film, we kind of see that latter idea of things winning out. But ultimately, the film becomes a very confronting depiction of how, you know, of the fate or the woes or the inevitabilities of Western liberal democracy kind of failing, I guess you could say. And this happens simultaneously on that political level, but also on a personal level for Lawrence himself. And we've talked about this on the show before, is when you can have parallel stories of things happening on a broader political level or a broader systemic level and on a more narrow individual or personal level, those two levels, then the stories happening in parallel can inform us, so the characteristics of one can kind of be ascribed to the characteristics of the other. So to put that into perspective, on the political level, we have, you know, it's 1962, so it's kind of this relatively early depiction of a kind of early decolonial view of the Middle East and the West's hand in what's happened in the Middle East. So depicted by things like broken promises and exploitation of a vulnerable people, and kind of manufactured or at least escalated divisions between tribes, which may or may not have had ancient hatreds, but it certainly had been sort of exacerbated or amplified through West interventionism and the war at large. And then equally to that, you have a personal story of Lawrence, who's this single man becoming increasingly drunk on his competence in the region. And we might even say this is a very sort of progressive view for 1962, right? All this stuff that, like, oh, you know, like, were they really that aware? Was David Lean really that aware in 1962 of like decolonial ideas? But then when you think about how sort of religious people were back then or before then even, it's not that punk rock to be saying that, you know, a human being can't be everything, mere mortal can't be a leader. And this is where sort of the Christ-like and divine imagery of the film and him wearing the all white and walking around with his robes and everything and standing in the face of a shooter and having this kind of view that he is. And this whole part of it is really the central aspect, or what I find to be particularly drawn to about the film, at least in the context of today's topic, which is the depiction of Peter O'Toole with his golden hair and the sun and the clear skies and sort of standing there as if he's some kind of Moses or Jesus-like figure. In 1962, we know that this is a man going above and beyond his means and his capabilities. And so that is very representative, as I sort of hinted at before, very representative of what the British were doing in the world at that time. Like, it's all well and good to see some kind of invincibility about oneself, but at the end of the day, you are just a group of people. You're not going to be able to solve all these problems. You're not a bunch of gods. You're not the gods of Olympus fixing these problems. You are people. You're bureaucrats. You're men in suits trying to figure out the world. No matter how robust Western liberal democracy is, it's not going to solve these problems. And it sounds weird saying that out loud. Like, isn't that kind of obvious? But it also feels like something that people need to learn. Like, there is such a privilege that we give Western liberal democracy. Like, the word democracy is a very valued word. And I'm not an anti, I'm not anti-democratic by any means. But it does, you know, we still need to say that out loud, that it can't solve all the problems of the world. We can't just throw democracy into the desert and hope it fixes all the problems. And equally, you know, the failings, if you're someone that is acutely aware of the failings of the state and the failings of British imperialism to fix issues in places like the Middle East, the same can be said about the individual person or the person as an individual. You can't just go into someone else's business on a personal level and fix all their problems. You're not capable of doing that. That's not something that you are. You aren't Christ. You can't go and wash or kiss someone's feet and cleanse them of their sins. That's not something that you have been endowed with. And so it's a very profound film in being able to tell those stories and inform both the personal and the political simultaneously. And so it leaves us with this kind of, I suppose, like a lasting impression, or it can, if you choose to interpret the film. I've got to be careful with my language on this show. And it can leave us with this lasting impression that one's influence and or intervention in a land or a place filled with vulnerable people is perhaps something that only the divine can do flawlessly. Like, we're all inevitably going to fail if we ever try and do that. And ironically, and this is very akin to the conversations we had when we talked about films like Killers of the Flower Moon and Akira. The idea, ironically, that when we go to intervene, when we try and solve a state of chaos, we can ironically create even more of a state of chaos in doing that, right? Sometimes what's required to solve a chaotic situation, sometimes the only way to solve a chaotic problem is through chaos. That's the only thing that's as powerful as chaos to solve chaos in a way. So, you know, interventionism kind of has a little bit of a bad look or isn't depicted positively, I suppose, by the end of Lawrence of Arabia. So is this always the case, though? Has this been the case throughout the rest of cinematic history? We always sort of had an impression of the Middle East and interventionism through that kind of lens. Well, before we move on to our next film, Shramadi Wallace, new 2XX98.3, People Powered Radio Station. This is Sacred Cinema. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi. And stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. And consider jumping onto our station to subscribe to the station or sponsor any of our shows. That would be something that would be fantastic. Yeah, if you could do that, you'd be a true hero in my eyes. But moving on now to the second film for today, Ridley Scott's 2001 Black Hawk Down. And we talked about in Lawrence of Arabia this idea of the sort of three archetypal groups of like the innocents, the aggressors, and the interveners, let's say. Well, in this film, we do also have the aggressors, which is the if you're not aware, Black Hawk Down is about the US military operation in Mogadishu in Somalia in 1993. And the aggressors, obviously, are the Somali, I don't want to use the wrong word here, but an aggressive militant group in Somalia that used, that caused pretty severe famine, let's put it that way. And then you've obviously got the interveners, which is the US, the Marines, right? But there's very little depiction of the innocents who are lost. Like, at the start of the film, you get a few images of, like, kids who are, like, struggling to eat, and there's a few cute kids running around the film who, like, are pretty starved and skinny and that sort of thing. But it's not really like an emphasis of this film, which is kind of interesting. And I think we can look back at a film like this and kind of laugh at it and be like, oh, look how tone deaf it is, da 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 da. But I want to kind of dispel the idea that films of this era actually were or remain to be tone deaf. There's an element of them that I think is definitely worth considering today. And I want to talk about how it talks about, you know, in Lawrence of Arabia, we talked a lot about how sort of interventionism is kind of doomed to fail. This film kind of talks about how interventionism, if we're serious about international compassion and humanitarianism, interventionism is a little bit of an inevitability. Like, it feels like it is something that is eventually going to have to happen, right? It may actually be written. So this is, of course, a Bush era desert warfare film. And so when we talk about the idea of the innocent people not even shown, like the Bush era, that sort of Team America era was you know, about the US being the world police. And in 2001, we kind of didn't really question it, or at least not in the mainstream. And so it was an era that was characterized by outside interventionism into volatile territories being something that was, I guess, a good thing. Like, we're living in the era of NATO and in the UN and the end of the Soviet Union and that sort of thing. And so in 2024, we can kind of laugh at that and say, like, well, obviously, we know this is just sort of neoconservatism. This is just neoliberalism and neocolonialism. But I think the strength of this film is how actually a bit like Lawrence of Arabia. It's able to tell, again, two parallel stories where one's able to inform the other. And I would almost go as far as to say that there's a particular storyline in this film that's quite a timeless idea. So the first obvious sort of storyline is one that I've kind of mentioned before, which is this classic sort of UN, NATO, Bush ideology of calling a war a genocide, right? And saying that, no, we need to intervene because this is more than just a civil war of two clashing groups. This is a crime against humanity. We need to go in here not as American citizens, not as UN fighters, but as human beings, right? And we've got the scene, which is even in the trailer of the film, where Sam Shepard's sort of saying, listen, this is not a war, this is a genocide. And in 2001, that kind of just equals, like, sort of in a kind of Clintonian sense, after Kosovo and Bosnia and all that sort of thing, like we, or Rwanda is probably a better example. We need to go in for the sake of our fellow man. It doesn't matter what flag we've got on our sleeve. We need to do this because people are suffering needlessly and out of, you know, ethnic cleansing and sort of racism, which is something we all stand against no matter what corner of the earth you stand on. And in 2024, we kind of go, well, is that actually what it's all about? Was it? Did it work? Come on, tell us what's really behind the curtain there. But I think this actually feeds into a really timeless idea, and it's something that's quite explicitly explored and something that's kind of impartial, which is that this never leave a man behindness, right? This is something that kind of no one would deny. Like, the idea of going back to save someone that needs you and putting your own life on the line to do that, that's not really a controversial idea. And that's what underpins this whole film, is that this is a botched mission, and the whole plot revolves around the character, the Eric Banner and all of these military guys going back to save their own men. It's not really about killing anyone. It's about saving lives and going back to save these people for the name, you know, in the name of human, you know, the sanctity of human life and that sort of thing. And this was very much a recurring idea in a lot of these films. The Mark Wahlberg film Lone Survivor is a lot like this as well. Speaking of Bosnia, the Owen Wilson Behind Enemy Lines is all about going back for the man who, you know, rather than leaving him to die, going back for him and that sort of thing. Armageddon has a little bit of that in it as well. And so this kind of explains why it's not really tone deaf that there isn't an innocent group, right? We've got the aggressors and we've got the interveners. Where are the innocents? Why aren't they depicted? Well, the innocents in this film are the interveners, right? They're the Americans. They're the innocents. They're the ones that are caught in this and needing to be saved, right? And you might sort of go, well, that's a bit weird thing to say, but if you think about it, if you think about the world as a humanitarian or a cosmopolitan entity, like in a truly classically liberal way, national borders don't really exist, so you don't have a distinction between interveners and innocents. They're the same thing. There's aggressors, and then there's innocents / interveners. Well, the interveners, I guess, just don't exist because they're not intervening anywhere. We're all part of one world, right? The UN knows no borders. The NATO knows no borders within its own territory, right? So that they are simply, you know, an attack on one person is an attack on everyone. To quote Spider-Man, you know, it's like New York, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us, right? So that's kind of why there isn't that urgency to depict that third group and why it kind of makes sense in 2001. And to go back to that idea, you know, no one really would disagree with the idea of never leaving a man behind. Like, if you knew something bad was happening to someone you care about and someone that you owe a duty to, you would. It's an honorable thing to go back to save them, right? And you might need to take a gun with you to do it, but saving someone and risking your life to do that is never considered a selfish act, like, no matter what you believe. So we have a bit of a contradiction here, because on one hand, Lawrence of Arabia is kind of reminding us that no mere mortal can go into a war zone and fix it. But we kind of have this sense of, like, well, we can't leave people just to die and suffer. On some level, we have to go into places. We do have to sort of intervene, or at least go into the places that they're suffering and help them if they're in trouble. You know, they're our own people, right? So is there a way that we can reconcile this, or is there a way that a film has tried to kind of reconcile this? And the third and final film we're going to talk about today is Denis Villeneuve's new film, Dune Part 2. Now, we didn't talk about Part 1 on the show. And that's, I guess, I'm going to focus specifically this week on the struggle that the main character, who's got like seven different names in the movie, but the Timothée Chalamet character, is him grappling with this prophecy that he's supposed to be the leader to save everyone. Now, obviously, talked before about all these desert films having some kind of biblical analogy, and I know that the Dune books, they're very deep. I haven't read the books, but I specifically want to focus on this idea of denying one's own destiny, denying something that seems written for the sake of a greater good, even if that seems like the greatest good one could imagine. So it's a small idea within the film, but I think it was an idea that definitely caught my curiosity when watching the film. So it's a very 2020s idea, I think. So we have this kind of certain specific kind of consciousness around being the kind of the white savior, I suppose you would say, is that we kind of have this self-consciousness around being an outsider and going in to lead people who are in a state of vulnerability. And this is certainly an idea that, you know, we sort of discussed when we talked about Lawrence of Arabia. But it's almost inherent when you watch the film, like the fact that, like, in today's culture where we are so sensitive towards sort of neo-colonialism and neo-imperialism and the white savior complex and not speaking for people who are vulnerable and letting them speak themselves. We get an inherent instinctual sense of that when we watch Timothée Chalamet walking around with the Fremen, who are in this case would be the archetypal innocents in this film. But it's not so simple as just to him to say, well, look, I'm not one of the Fremen. You know, this is cultural appropriation, me coming in here and doing all that stuff. I'll leave you guys to look out for yourselves. Because not only is he a powerful person, he's a good fighter, but also it's literally written. So in the same way that we talked about this idea of it being written in Lawrence of Arabia and the idea of prophecy, there's a literal prophecy in the Dune story where Timothée Chalamet has to deal with the fact that while he feels awkward helping out the Fremen, he is the one that has to do it, so much so that even the local people, the Javier Bardem character, who is one of the Fremen people, he adores him for this. He's almost more keen than he is, than Timothée is, to help him out. And eventually, not to give away too much in the film, but he himself, Timothée Chalamet, can't really deny the power he has and the influence he could have and what he could do to help these people, even despite sort of his deeper personal romantic goals. So I think speaking about it in the context of Lawrence of Arabia, and I can't help but think there's some very clear like ties between the two films in terms of what makes a good leader as an outsider in a sort of desert setting, in a setting of scarcity. We have this kind of simultaneous adherence and subversion of that idea in Lawrence of Arabia, right? Where it's almost like, we're empowering the vulnerable. You empower the vulnerable by denying what is written. So in Lawrence of Arabia, the vulnerable group, the Arabs, had this view of what was written, and that was challenged by Lawrence of Arabia, but it turns out Lawrence of Arabia was wrong all along, or ended up being wrong. Timothée Chalamet kind of has to empower the people that he's supposed to lead by denying the things that they believe. But the things that they believe is him to be in power, right? So it's this endless sort of paradoxical relationship with what is written, what is inevitable, what is the religious or the divine belief of that local people. And when you apply that to sort of any kind of topic that's related to this week's topic, any kind of situation that's happening in the world that's related, we do feel this a lot of the time, that when we look at sort of a vulnerable group, we feel that the best way to help you is, like, I want to adhere to the things that you believe, but it's almost through, like I don't believe them, I'm not part of that culture, so it's not through me believing them that you're going to be empowered. But also on some level I feel like I need to almost deny that of certain groups, you know, especially things around like theocracy. Like, theocracy can be such a suffocating thing. Having deep religious ties that create a very narrow and suffocating political infrastructure or political structure can be something that you kind of want to say, like, listen, I respect your beliefs, I respect your spirit, but you're endowing too many people too much power. It's better for your own sake. And so we have to kind of, it almost feels like we need to deny the spirituality or deny the religiosity of people that we're trying to help, even though that in and of itself is extremely colonial, is extremely imposing and interventionist. And I also think this tension, and no one's going to talk about the casting of this film being one of its strengths, but because it's so visually breathtaking and the sound is amazing and the score is fantastic, but I think the casting is really clever. Like, Timothée Chalamet is, like, he's a privileged white male, but he's also really famous and everyone can't stop looking at him on the screen. Like, everyone's obsessed with him. So it's like there is this sort of this internal contradiction of, like, well, he's not supposed to be a leader, we can't help feel that he should be a leader. And similarly with the Zendaya character, like, and I'm going to get a little bit meta-modern here, but, you know, she's the full package in terms of a 21st century hero. Like, she's a female, she's a woman of color, she's, you know, she's very outspoken and forthright and strong as a character. Why isn't she the lead of this movie? Well, because in the books, she's not the... Well, I haven't read all the books, but I'm assuming that in the books, she's not the protagonist. So it's literally written that she's not the hero, even though it feels in our gut that she should be. And I feel I got a bit of a feeling of that with, like, Oppenheimer as well, a little bit. Like, a lot of the people talking about Oppenheimer are like, oh, why does it have to be a straight white male all the time? And it's like, well, that's kind of what happened in history. And people want to be like, yeah, but can't we tell a story where he's not, you know, we tell a story of someone who's like, well, it's like, well, that was the story. So we kind of had to, anyway, I'm getting too past the point. The main point I want to make here is that there is a tension here between a sense of inevitability about who really needs to be a leader, who needs to impose some kind of influence, and a sense of awkwardness about not wanting to be interventionist, not wanting to be the one that fixes it up from sort of an outsider's perspective. So where are we at? All right, this is a very confusing point. So at the beginning, we talk about Lawrence of Arabia. We get the sense that we kind of have to be conscious of the failings of interventionism, right? Too much overreach by mere mortals is going to lead to the compounding of what's already a chaotic situation in a lot of contexts. We can't just assume that we have these godlike qualities. God is a specific thing, and even though we might resemble God or feel like God in certain moments, be it on an individual or political level, no one is God that lives and stands on the earth. So we have to be very careful we don't reach too far. But at the same time, we can't deny our sense of humanity and human citizenshipness. We need to step in at some point to help people who are in a vulnerable state. So it leaves us with a very awkward power imbalance. We live in a very sort of funny situation where we almost feel like there is this inherent problem, right, in being privileged Westerners, if I can speak for myself for a second. This is inherent problem in being sort of a privileged Westerner, not wanting to intervene, not wanting to be patronizing, not wanting to be paternal, not wanting to reach too far, not wanting to be the person that just sort of shows up and says, hey, look, the prophecy, it's written, it's everywhere. Even your own religion says that I'm the God that's going to fix all these problems, just let me in. We feel that's too much of an overreach, but there is this inevitability, there's this inevitable sense that we do need to do something. We do need to help. We do have all these resources. We do have all this competence as political infrastructures. Even if you're sort of if you're a well-off person, you have a financial influence that you can make. You can urge people to do things differently and live their lives differently. We do feel inevitability. There is this inevitability that we should, or that we can help, or that we should help. So perhaps what we need to do is be wary about, like, looking forward. Maybe we need to be wary about senses of destiny, right, in viewing our role in serving the staff, right? Maybe it's not a sense of destiny. Maybe it's something that we do simply just as human beings in a given situation. But keeping in mind that eventually, inevitably, a hero does need to rise out of the sand. That's all we've got time for this week here on Sacred Cinema on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on the People Powered Radio station. And be sure to stay tuned for more quality radio content here on 2XX, or jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring any of our shows. You can email me as well at contact@jimmybernasconi.com. But thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next week. Bye.